he will do his best to respond to you. Thanks, Paul. So we let you go.
Yeah.
If you talk about it, there's the economic changes that differ in an academic institution, have you seen how the market economy or capitalism has influenced educational institutions or how learning or...
Gould mentioned that I did my training in Oxford, an educational system that developed out of the worldview of the Middle Ages. And the basic understanding of education, which is embedded in the Oxford tutorial system, is one in which you ask to be apprenticed by a master, and you are educated and indeed formed as a person in relationship with somebody who is apprenticing you. Contrast that with the typical North American campus university, in which education is a consumer object, that the student comes to purchase the education that they want and expect that to be delivered by the suppliers of that product. So in that, I think that's very clearly a whole area of life that's been invaded by this mentality. Yes, David.
Thank you, Paul, for a wonderful, wide-ranging and stimulating presentation. I think one of the interesting things about your biography that we learned at the beginning is that you are not just a theorist, but also an advisor, consultant. And so I'm wondering how you, in a sense, adjudicate the wide-ranging presentation you gave us in terms of concrete state policy. And Anthony Giddens, who you quoted a couple of times, of course, is known as a major theorist behind the third way, mm-hmm. the Blairite view. So I'm wondering, is that the best exemplar we could see of in a society the implications of what you're saying, or would a better exemplar be perhaps France, where a tremendously defensive posture towards globalization, a suspicion of globalization, has diffused the whole society? But according to an in-depth survey in The Economist recently, at the cost of, shall we say, happiness to a large number, because of the protection of happiness for a few in a kind of a government contained closed shop. So I'm just wondering how you see the outworking of the set of propositions,
yes.
and assessments you gave us in a concrete policy sense, because this is something you've done.
Yes. Clearly there are major connections between Giddens and the whole third way, but I don't believe that the experience of Britain shows any real attempt to resist globalization in practice. That is the whole sort of tradition for Britain has been of a very open trading economy. And so to put up any kind of barrier has been would be really going against the grain. And I don't think there's been any real sustained attempt to do that. In the very early days, there was a lot of talk about raising restrictions on capital flows within the country. I was involved in working with the Minister for Regional Policy, and there was a lot of discussion about trying to bring in some of the kind of restrictions on capital flows that had been embedded in the German lender system of regional banking, and to reintroduce regional stock markets, regional financial structures, in order to sort of stop this process of within Britain of constant centralisation of all political, economic and cultural power towards London. That basically hit the roadblock of voter popularity very early on, and was sort of consigned to the policy wastebin. The only elements that were kept were really the most ineffectual ones, namely to create new governance structures. So we have new governance structures, but of course they have budgets of perhaps £100 million, and they are trying to deal with problems that are driven by pension funds with £100 billion. So they have absolutely no ability to really influence anything, and yet they have, having advised quite a few of these, the level of frustration that's arisen is very high, because the aspirations are all still there in the white papers and the policy documents, and they've travelled through into the people who take on the role of running these regional organisations, but they really have, and they are measured on things like how well they raise the rate of growth of GDP, or the level of unemployment falling, or so on, in the northern region. Well, you can imagine what influence £100 million will have on a region in a country that's as integrated as the United Kingdom. It would be like a completely different situation in some ways, even to the provincial system in Canada. So I think that if one were to embed some of the things I've been saying in policy at that kind of macro level, the first thing to target would be the capital mobility. So I think that they were on to the right thing. They were trying to do it at regional scale rather than national scale. They backed away from it. But I think that if you take an example of a country like Malaysia, which did in fact, contrary to the expectations and the received wisdom of the IMF, impose capital controls for a time, actually seemed to do that country a great deal of good, rather than being exposed to the constant speculative flow. So I think that in concrete policy terms, it's probably the openness to capital mobility that is the thing one would want to really focus on. All right.
There's a fairly visible movement among certain segments of the late early 21st century counterculture folks that comes under a number of movements, like the general term bioregionalism, for example, which says go in the other direction, try to eat locally, buy locally, try to know who you are affecting in your economic choices. That's such as community-supported agriculture, for example. Is this just a futile gesture? Or does it have any visibility on the larger? Basically, it's saying educate people to learn to be connected, and maybe that will change the global economy. Is a concept of bioregionalism that will have any place in the current economic thinking?
Well, the European Union is very keen on it. Their whole policy framework is structured in terms of sustainable development, which is their phrase for this. And they throw a lot of money relative to the money they have to throw around at the development of strategies for sustainable cities, sustainable development. So Manchester, for example, in the United Kingdom, has had a major bioregional strategy, 20-year strategy. London has had one. Many cities in Europe adopt the same approach. Certainly those are valuable, but if you're asking, and bring real benefit, but if you're asking me, will they fundamentally be able to withstand the kind of flows of capital that they are exposed to, then the answer simply has to be no. That's not to say that one shouldn't pursue them or affirm the goods that they are affirming, but I don't really see that they are going to be able to significantly alter the outcomes in an environment of global capital movements. Yes, go on.
Could you address the issue of the growing separation between the wealthy and the poor? It seems that there are some, we hear more about that in the news all the time, that there are also some political implications of that, and some, that there's another aspect of globalization that will, in terms of conflicts, jealousy between the sectors of the world. But it seems that there's a wedge driving a distance between our wealthy and poor through globalization that is quite a strong concern.
Yes, I mean, I'm not sure particularly what you're referring to, but it's certainly the case that if you look at the kind of arguments that develop between the sort of globalization critics and the globalization enthusiasts tend to be along the following lines. On the one hand, the enthusiasts will say, well, poorer people are richer today than they used to be. In absolute terms. And on the other hand, critics will say, well, that may be true, but relative to everyone else, they're much further behind. So it may be true that in terms of GDP per capita, one can see growth at all social levels. And let's just assume that that's the case. It's not completely true. But the sort of statistics you have are that the poorest 20% of the world now receive something like 1% of global income relative to maybe 5% 10, 20 years ago, whereas the top 20% have seen their share grow from something like 60% to 80%. So what's at stake is not simply the absolute level of income, but it is the gap between the rich and the poor. And I think this is a theme that Scripture is concerned about, that not the vision I think we see of socioeconomic culture in the Old Testament, particularly in the Jubilee institutions of Leviticus 25, are not to try to eliminate inequality, but certainly to hold it within boundaries that don't that permit the genuine inclusion of every person in a community on a reasonably equal power relationship. So once you get these huge and growing differentials, then there really is no sense in which you have a level playing field. The world is not flat at all. And indeed, that's one of the critiques one could bring against the globalization enthusiasts on the very grounds, on the very terms of their own arguments, because the more that process goes on, the more, in fact, the basis for individual freedom becomes undermined. I think, yeah.
But perhaps we need a global taxation recovery agency.
A global IRS is a very frightening prospect. But I mean, one of the proposals that Giddens makes is not his proposal; he endorses it. Taxing speculative capital flows, I think, is an extremely good idea. In fact, just about everybody thinks it's a really good idea, apart from the United States government. It was proposed by a U.S. economist called James Tobin, and it's become known as the Tobin tax. And his proposition is very simple, that you simply put a tax on short-term movements of money to dampen that kind of instability. And if the movements are genuinely long-term, then you have tax relief. So that is not perhaps as far as you might want to go, but it would certainly do quite a lot to get rid of the instability in the system. And I've not seen, to be honest with you, a serious economic argument against that proposition. The arguments against it are entirely political. Yeah.
There's been a lot of talk lately about Canada's relationship with China and relation to objectionable human rights practices and also trade and the interplay between those two. I was wondering if you have any comment on how that sort of political stuff can fit into some of the responses to globalization that you're talking about earlier.
Well, I can't comment too specifically on Canadian-Chinese relations. But I think that what we typically often see is a capitulation of the political or indeed any moral vision to the economic sort of reality or driver. And I suspect that may well be the case here, in that you'll hear a lot of rhetoric, but I very much doubt that Canada will engage in any kind of trade sanctions or anything like that with China. I'm not sure whether that answers your question, but... I think it's, of course, what one could critique the particular, respond to your question by looking at the particular moral visions that you're talking about. In other words, what is it that the notion of human rights is based on, and how far might we want to defend it, as well as critique it. I think that it would not be in sort of unmitigated good, it would not be an unqualified good to successfully impose the notion of individualistic rights on another country. That's different, of course, to arguing from a different moral basis for the treatment of human persons. But I'm not quite sure where to go with your question, so I'll leave it at that. Sorry, Sarah. Yeah.
Just looking for hope somewhere in this. If what we need to do is be located moral leaders reconceptualizing the economic landscape, but we can't enter in at a grassroots level, and we're waiting dependently on a political process where the democratic populace has been trained in this economic system to think and to, you know, to assume everything's economic. What's our local engagement?
Yeah. Well, I think that what we're up against is this relativizing tendency that any new moral vision, very quickly, if it's got any substance to it, i.e. if there's some truth underlying it, some authenticity, it gets subverted into meeting the needs of the economy. So, and you see this even in the way people argue morally, that in this arena, that the notion of social capital, for example, is often propounded on the basis that it will improve economic performance. And that is a very common move, because the whole culture of the debate forces you into that is the only thing that has explanatory power. If it doesn't improve the performance of the economy, then it's irrelevant. So that's what we're up against, and I think that, and of course not just us, you know, many observers and critics of capitalism recognize goods within the market system, but also lots of other goods that it will not recognize. And that's the sense in which I'm advocating moral leadership at any scale, of simply constantly affirming that there are other things than individual freedom and rationality to pursue, and that they are also meaningful and useful, in order to try to sort of halt this constant relativizing tendency. Because until one can do that, it's going to be very hard to see any restructuring of our culture in ways that actually will enable some of these other goods to flourish. And the notion of social capital is a good example, because if one can successfully demonstrate that there is economic value. So it may be that this is, although it seems like supping with the devil, you know, and Luther's comment, you need a very long spoon to be doing that. It may be the route that one has to go, arguing that increased relational proximity, improvements in trust networks, in the level of trust in a culture, has a lot of economic value, reduces transactions costs, does all these wonderful things. And therefore, we need to do something about some of the absolutizing of market freedom and deregulation. Well, that might at least enable society to be restructured in ways that allow some of these things to be nurtured again. Whereas at the moment, we're finding a culture in which, even when you want to live in a completely different way, it becomes harder and harder, in fact, to do that. It's harder and harder to stay rooted in one place. It's harder and harder to continue to live in a way where you are near to your extended family. These things have become, although they used to be taken for granted, they are now becoming not only lifestyle choices, but unavailable lifestyle choices almost, unless you're willing to trade off a huge amount of other material things. And that's the kind of drift that we need to be able to see reversing. Gary.
Yeah, I take it from your talk that you would like to see capital mobility reduced drastically in every way, within nations, regionally, across nations, and not just restricting hot capital flows, but the whole thing. First of all, I know that, is that right? That's what you feel, what you feel strongly about, that this is the main thing you've got to home in on, is somehow restricting capital mobility, and that will get somehow to the heart of this, the things that are threatening about globalization.
I do think that capital mobility is important. I think that the kind of speculative capital flows is the sort of number one target, perhaps. But I think that the example of the sort of process that I'm concerned to see reversed, and I'll use Britain as an example because I have the examples more easily to hand, is one in which a reasonably coherent economy in Northern England, in which there is a diversity of employment for a range of different skill sets, starts to be undermined by a process of completely free movement of capital. And the way it typically happens is that the savers in, I'll summarize it by talking of the North. So the savers in the North find that their savings are recycled by the financial system and invested where returns to capital are highest. Returns to capital are highest in London, so they're invested in London. They may well be invested by a multinational company that then buys one of the companies in the northern region. And having bought it, it moves all the high-value activities back to its head office in London. In doing that, all of the higher level jobs have been taken from that more peripheral to London region in a process that starts to concentrate power, wealth, and opportunity in one region at the expense of the other. And then you find a situation in which, as unemployment starts to rise, a politician like Norman Tebbit will say, well, you need to get on your bike that's a quote, and move from the northern region in order to get work in the south. So then you find the population dislocation of people moving in order to get work, because the system has undermined the coherence of the local economy that they, in a previous generation, could have stayed in and found work in. So that's the kind of process that I'm wanting to see halted. I'm not trying to sort of say that all investment outside of the local area is bad, but I am wanting to see some halt to that constant process of concentration that goes on. And you can tell the same kind of story pretty much any scale you like. Is that okay? Sorry, yes.
But the ultimate good that you're going to achieve from this is more permanent communities where there's a real community feel and trust and lots of social capital, much lower scale enterprise, smaller scale enterprises, a more human sort of capitalism.
Yes. And one could argue that it may be a capitalism that's particularly appropriate in a century where we will run out of oil, we will not be able to finance virtually free transportation of goods all around the world in order to save ourselves, in order to provide sort of fresh strawberries in December. In an environment where we're doing an awful lot of damage to the environment. So there are other benefits, if you like, to what I'm discussing.
One more thing.
Yes.
It seems that you also have to stop labor mobility. In other words, if you did what you just had in mind with Northern England and restricted the capital to be invested in Northern England, then it seems to me you're also, the logic of it's going to extend to saying, and we will not allow large flows of labor from the south of England up here to Scotland, because we want to preserve these smaller communities and a hands-on approach to capitalism, etc. Because when the rate of earnings by capital go down there, you know, the other side of that's going to be a rise in wages, and there's going to be a natural tendency of pulling labor from the south of England.
Well, I'm not sure that's the case at all, actually. I don't think that you need to put restrictions on labor mobility. Labor is typically and internationally far less mobile than capital, for obvious and very good reasons. It tends to be the highly skilled who are the most mobile, but I don't think that having placed some sort of restriction on capital mobility that it would be necessary to place any restriction on labour mobility. But we can maybe pick that up. But there's a question. Yes. Here.
Well, you sort of opened the door here, but I'm wondering if all of this will be forced upon us with the oil coming to an end, and if we could elaborate more on that aspect of if will 15 years, 20 years from now, oil commodity be low enough that some of
the movement
just can't
happen. The truth is, we simply don't know what kind of adjustment our cultures will make to an era in which there isn't plentiful cheap oil. There's a huge range of forecasts as to when we will reach the point where it's impossible for supply to continue to meet the rising demand. When we do reach that point, there's a whole cluster of forecasts that's going to happen in the next 10 years. And then there are also some forecasts that it won't happen until 2050. And there are a few people who think it will never happen. And the argument there is simply that the higher the price of oil goes up, the more cost effective it will be to dig a bit deeper and find some more. That's a sort of endless supply thesis. Point that happens, we don't know what kind of energy transition we'll make. But the reason for me saying what I said is that the way in which we use oil right now that will be affected immediately and to the greatest degree is in transportation. And that, of course, is what largely fuels in an unnoticed way this whole integration of the global economy. If in fact you find that the transactions cost of moving goods around the world becomes significant in your business plan, then all of a sudden it stops being efficient to organize yourself in the ways that we organize ourselves now. So, you know, a substantial rise in the price of oil may well see a lot of industries restructuring, at least at the continental level rather than at the global level, so that there's not the need for so much physical movement. So that has some promise, but, you know, we might be waiting for a few years, we might be waiting for a very long time before that starts to kick in. Now, there's another question here.
I just want to come back on the
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That in one of the relativizing forces in the information economy is the increasing value, the increasing proportion of income that will be paid to owners of human capital relative to owners of physical capital. And that will have some kind of relativizing effect, some kind of mitigating effect. But bear in mind that that is only true for a certain type of highly privileged sort of worker that certainly does not constitute the majority of the working population. So it will be of some benefit, but only to the sort of people who are likely to sort of, you know, read lectures on globalization.
So one final question.
Yes.
What is the definition of theology of the public good?
Oh my goodness. what is my definition of it? Well, I'm not quite sure that I'm going to offer a definition, but I would simply want to say, if I'm only going to say one thing about the theology of the public square, it would be this, that the public implications of the gospel have for a very long time been ignored by evangelicals in particular. There has been a substantial disengagement by the portions of the Christian community from the rest of society, and that constitutes quite a significant problem that needs redressing. So one of the biggest issues in theology of the public square for a great deal of the Christian community is to learn again how to dialogue in the marketplace, how to translate, how to learn, I like to use the metaphor of Daniel, how to learn the language and literature of the Babylonians, and to learn how to translate into that language in order to be able to make a contribution. So, yeah, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much for all your questions and your attention.